show that we have students from the University School of Milwaukee with us today. Will they and their advisor please stand? Very good. Thank you. You may be seated. Two of my grandkids graduated from university school. They went to grade school, and then they graduated from high school, and then they wandered off to California to go to college, if you can imagine. So we're very happy to have you with us, and thank you for bringing the students in. They come every year to visit. So they'll know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us in a minute. Students, if you can remain after this case is concluded, Justice Rebecca Dallet, right down here at the end, will come down and chat with you a little bit about the case. She won't talk about the merits or what she thinks of the issues, but she'll tell you a lot about how cases get to the Supreme Court and probably answer questions that you'll find interesting, too. Anybody else that's here that would like to stay for Justice Dallet's presentation, of course, is welcome as well. Now, you will notice that we are sitting six on this case. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley has recently withdrawn from participation, so she will not be assisting the court in our decision on the issues that you bring before us. With that little announcement in mind, are you prepared to proceed, counsel?
I am.
Please do.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Craig Powell, and I represent the plaintiff in this case, David Skinjaleski. We are asking this court to recognize a narrow exception to the innocence requirement in criminal malpractice cases. David Skinjaleski was prosecuted and convicted in violation of the statute of limitations for misdemeanor offenses. The law prohibited this prosecution regardless of Mr. Skinjaleski's guilt. His lawyer, the defendant in this matter, failed to identify this basic fact and instead counseled guilty. Mr. Skinjaleski did so and spent 124 days in a state prison facility until that matter was rectified on appeal and he was ordered released.
Counsel, would you help me understand a little bit more about where exactly you want this line to be drawn? I think in your briefs you framed it as if something was unauthorized by law, but that strikes me as a somewhat vague phrase. I wondered if you might put some flesh on the bones for that for us here, or maybe it's to the facts of this case, maybe it's just to when there's something above the maximum sentencing, but if you might throw out exactly what it is you're proposing us to say the exception looks like.
Sure. So I recognize Justice's issue or problem with how things have been, how we're seeking to address the definition of the exception we're seeking. I think that comes in part from the rarity in which these sorts of issues occur. And if you look, for example, at the Powell case in the state of Washington, which we, of course, rely on somewhat significantly, they distilled the issue down to that innocence is not required to be shown where the trial court imposes a sentence it had no authority order. I think that is one way of saying it. That is a way that would apply to Mr. Skinjaleski's case. I think that formulation would apply to Mr. Skinjaleski.
But wasn't the formulation in Powell based on receiving a sentence longer than was permitted by law? And the idea was the time that he served was related to his culpable behavior. The excess beyond the maximum could not be related to his culpable behavior, right? Wasn't that the rationale?
That is. I think that rationale carries through very cleanly to the situation.
All right. So here, the statute of limitations protected him from prosecution, but for the statute of limitations, he would have served perhaps even longer than he did spend in jail, correct?
Well, if we assume the prosecution would have brought the case in it within time.
Yes.
And everything else played out similarly, then yes, he would have served a sentence within the statutory maximum.
Okay. So here's my concern. I'm trying to figure out what kind of circumstances, if we agree with your argument here, what kind of circumstances would we thereafter require innocence as a precondition to the cause of action?
What kind of conditions would you require innocence?
Yes.
I think almost all situations would remain. The ones that jump out at me
Give me an example.
Mr. Nunnery's case, Hicks v. Nunnery, is an example, of how it's appropriately applied. I think there you have a situation where a defendant's conviction is reversed on ineffective assistance of counsel based on his lawyer's failure to investigate an alibi witness and do some due diligence on DNA work. That ineffectiveness in and of itself doesn't establish that Mr. Hicks was innocent. And so that is something he would have to prove under the policy preferences under Hicks v. Nunnery.
Yeah. So let me just start paring it back for you. So let's say that defense counsel, he blows a motion to suppress. He fails to bring a motion to suppress when it would have been granted if he had, right? So in that circumstance, would he be able to sue his counsel?
I think not. And I think for example, Wiley and the other cases that adopt the innocence requirement frequently point to, as an example, perhaps the defense lawyer failing to file a suppression motion. But what suppression motions, the through thinking process there is, if it's a valid suppression motion, exclusion of the evidence would follow, and then perhaps no conviction would follow. But those things don't necessarily follow.
Well, let's say it does.
So
we go back and he says, look, here's the motion that should have been brought. Court of Appeals agrees, reverses it, the state says, well, that's all the evidence that we had. And so they don't prosecute. So can he sue his lawyer?
I think not. Again, because I think what we're dealing with there is consistent with the concept of a windfall acquittal, which is really what the policy against rewarding a guilty defendant with damages in a malpractice action gets to. And that is the fact that someone who is guilty may, in fact, be found not guilty at a trial because he had a skilled lawyer, for example. But that's the kind of windfall we don't want malpractice damages to represent.
And please help me with his pronunciation. Skinjaleski. Skinjaleski. All right. Well, he was guilty. He got a windfall.
He was, but the difference here is, and why it fits in with the sentencing exception cases, is you have a statutory right for Mr. Skinjaleski's case not to be prosecuted. It is very similar to the legislature setting forth the statutory maximums for a particular penalty. So the legislature has set the limits. So we know that if I'm convicted of theft by a contractor, as Mr. Skinjaleski admitted doing, and I'm sentenced to 12 months as opposed to the 9-month maximum, those 3 months at the end under Powell, in cases like Powell, would allow me to recover because it's outside the limits of what the legislature has said I can be punished for my behavior.
Yeah, but how is that different from the suppression motion where you can successfully suppress all the state's evidence? Right. And so you were convicted, you went to jail, eventually got it overturned, and is dismissed, right? And there we could equally say, well, there was a law that made his conviction unlawful.
Well,
and similarly to this, they're both guilty.
Here's a distinction I make, Justice Kelly. The exclusionary rule does not vest a right in the defendant. It's not a right of the defendant. The exclusionary rule, which is how we enforce Fourth Amendment rights, is a doctrine created by the courts to deter police misconduct. It's not a right that vests in the defendant, like Mr. Skinjaleski.
Right.
Unlike the statute.
I get that. So why is the fact that a statute of limitations defense is a right, why does that make a difference to the innocence requirement?
Because the innocence requirement, what we talk about, let me back up. So the policy preferences regarding the innocence requirement dealt with causation. That's where it sort of comes down. Is the cause of the defendant's injuries his own behavior or the attorney's malfeasance in a given case? In the statute of limitations context, Your Honor, once that statute has run, a defendant cannot be prosecuted even if guilty. So at that moment in time, the defendant's behavior no longer becomes the cause of his incarceration. It cannot be the legal cause because he cannot be prosecuted. That is the difference. Suppression issues are more like the guilty-in-fact defendant who is successfully or skillfully represented and manages to be acquitted based on the heavy burden to the state.
How about when the guy got convicted because of the unskillful behavior of the attorney? We say there's a Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel, and that's a constitutional right, not a statutory right, the constitutional right that belongs to the defendant. So if that gets violated, wouldn't he have a cause of action against his attorney?
Under Nunnery, Wiley, in those cases, they do not, because those cases lump in constitutional protections unique to the criminal justice system as not creating an independent cause of action for a violation of the right.
Counsel, isn't this really just a matter of public policy choice? And shouldn't we leave it to the legislature if they want to make a change? But Hicks has been out there for a long time.
Is exactly a public policy question, Your Honor, and has been set forth by the legislature already through the statute of limitations.
Well, I don't, the statute of limitations can be waived. This isn't, in the statute of limitations, it doesn't take away the crime. It's not like a statute of repose, where when the statute of repose clicks in, the claim is totally gone. So, statutes of limitations can be waived, and I really don't see the state drawing the kind of bar that it did in Powell, where the state said you may not sentence the defendant to more than a given number of years, and then when that occurred, of course, you had to comply with the policy choice the legislature made. I don't think the legislature has made such a policy choice with statutes of limitation.
Well, the legislature didn't make the policy choice in Hicks versus Nunnery either. The Court of Appeals made that choice. What we're talking
about, I remember.
So what we're talking about is, well, the Court is correct that the statute of limitations could be waived by someone. It was not here.
No.
It's also true that once the statute of limitations run, it denies the circuit court of jurisdiction over the offense. So
it may deny him competence, but I doubt it changes the court's jurisdiction.
I think under John v. State, it referenced jurisdiction, Your Honor, in my brief.
Well, but we can argue about that another day.
Fair enough. But that is where, in the legislature, by the way, did not create an exception in the statute of limitations that says, by the way, this doesn't apply to you if you actually did it. It's the bright line. 3 years on misdemeanor. Once that line is crossed, the person cannot be prosecuted, even if guilty. And that's where the causation element of a malpractice claim comes in, because at that point, the defendant's criminal behavior cannot be the cause of his incarceration, legal cause of his incarceration.
So this gets limited to criminal context as well, because I hear the chief talking about waiving statute of limitations. You can't waive those in a criminal case. The state either brings it during the time or they don't, right? So we're not thinking of extending this to some kind of statute of limitations in civil. Right?
Correct. The innocence requirement only relates to civil cases against criminal defense lawyers. In the criminal context, I take Chief Justice's point to be a defendant, for example, for a favorable plea bargain could waive the statute of limitations on a, say, an amended offense or an out-of-time offense to take advantage of a plea bargain. That happens occasionally. It can be done.
Right, but is that considered really a waiver of the statute of limitations, or is it considered the ability to take the charge that's in front of the court and accept something lesser than that?
Well, for example, let's say there's a first-degree intentional homicide case charge that's a what they call a cold case. It's been around for a long time. And a plea deal is sort of struck where a lesser-included offense, say first- or second-degree reckless homicide, that statute has run. And if that case was presented to the jury, that couldn't happen. I think a defendant could properly waive the
statute. Right, but they're not really waiving it on that lesser defense because they're charged with the greater. I mean, it's a different framework. I just don't think that argument helps you. If you talk about the fact that you can waive the statute of limitations, then it does become something other than the preference of the legislature in a hard and fast line. So that's why I asked the question.
But it wasn't done here, and it wasn't done because the lawyer didn't identify the issue, discuss it with Mr. Skinjaleski, and give him the opportunity. Had that discussion been taken place, the case would have been dismissed. So it's not at all like the plea bargaining context where it can be waived. It's simply there would be no reason, tactical, strategic, or otherwise, to ever do that in a single count case where the single count is barred. And so we look, I think, to the exception cases and why those are comparable. And most of those cases have dealt with sentencings out of time, sentences beyond the maximum. As the Powell Court noted, once a defendant is incarcerated beyond the statutory maximum, that person then takes the position more like an innocent person than someone trying to take advantage of their own wrongdoing. Because, as I've said before, the legislature set the limits. Incarceration outside that should be recoverable. And in this way, I think the statute of limitations issues are very analogous. In Powell, it was a defendant who pled to a misdemeanor that had a 12-month maximum. He was sentenced to 38 and a quarter months. By the time that was sorted out, he had served 20 months. That claim was allowed to proceed. In Oregon and Johnson versus Babcock, the statutory maximum was 80 months, and the defendant was sentenced to 30 years somehow, but he served more than 80 months. That was deemed to be recoverable. In the Eastern District of Virginia, in Jones versus Link, a federal case, that particular defendant was not allowed to recover because although his attorney made an error in calculating the federal sentencing guidelines, the correction to the sentencing guidelines on appeal did not result in him serving a longer or illegal sentence. But the Jones court recognized that in these sentencing context cases, it would be wrong to deny someone recovery on innocence grounds.
Counsel, could I bring you back a moment, too? I feel like you you might have had something more to say in your answer to one of my questions. So we were talking about constitutional rights, rights that are affirmatively granted to defendants.
Yes.
And how violation of those rights does not give rise to a cause of action against the lawyer, but a violation of a statutory right does. Can you explain to me that distinction?
Sure. I think the courts, like Wiley, like Nunnery versus Hicks, who've adopted the innocence requirement, talk about these procedural protections that are unique to the criminal justice system. The right to the effective assistance of counsel, for example, the suppression remedy Your Honor has talked about before, that those violations of those particular issues can be resolved through existing post-conviction issues, habeas corpus remedies, because someone who is guilty but received ineffective assistance of counsel, their remedy on an ineffective assistance claim, for example, is a new trial. That's what they should have had in the first place. That makes some sense. If you're innocent and you can prove it, then you're entitled to more than that, which is recompense for the time you were incarcerated. So natural limitations.
Where do you get that from?
I'm sorry?
Where do you get that from? The right to recompense for time spent in jail if you are eventually acquitted?
Well,
the statute that says that.
Yeah, and if you're able to prove your innocence on the malpractice piece, Your Honor. Right. And I think there's a case.
Yeah, I know. But here's what I'm trying to figure out from you, though. There are affirmatively constitutional rights that defendants have. And you acknowledge that those do not give rise to a cause of action against an attorney. And you're saying that the violation of a statutory right does. And what you've given me so far is that the constitutional rights are unique to the criminal justice system. Okay, I'll grant you that. Why does that matter?
Statutes of limitation are not unique.
No, I know, but why does that matter?
Because this case is about public policy preferences, Your Honor. And the statute is enacted by the legislature, the elected representatives of the people, signed into law by the governor, the elected representative of the people. There is no clear statement of public policy than the enactment of law in that fashion. And the statutes say, here is the cutoff. This person cannot be prosecuted regardless of guilt or innocence at this point.
We say that in double jeopardy claims. That's a clear statement, and it's a constitutional statement.
I'm glad you raised that particular one, Your Honor, because in Levine versus Kling, the Seventh Circuit case, it's dicta, but the court does suggest quite clearly that double jeopardy would be a recognizable claim outside the innocence requirement.
Why is that?
Because it bars prosecution at its inception. That's where it's invalidated.
Well, that's half of it. The other half is he's already been punished for the culpable behavior. That's the whole point of double jeopardy, right?
Yes.
Okay. And in here,
he's already been prosecuted.
I'm sorry?
Already been prosecuted, not necessarily punished. He could have been acquitted.
Possible.
Yeah.
Right. So, but in any event, the guilt issue has already been either adjudicated or he's suffered the consequences of his culpable behavior. And that's not the case in a statute of limitations defense.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think the question of the adjudication of guilt or innocence ceases to be relevant in any manner at the passing of the statute of limitations.
Well, now that's a little bit problematic from a logical standpoint, because now you're assuming your conclusion in your premises. The question before us is whether innocence is relevant, whether we need to grapple with that. That's the whole point of this case.
Correct.
You can't simply assume that away.
Well, innocence ceases to be relevant when the issue is not about the fact of conviction, correct? And let's assume this case is just as much about an unlawful sentence of Mr. Skinjaleski as an unlawful conviction. Both things are unlawful. Every second he spent in jail pursuant to this conviction was improper and unlawful. He couldn't be punished based on what the law provides. So his guilt or innocence is not relevant to this unique set of facts. Much like guilt or innocence is not relevant once someone spends a day in prison beyond the maximum.
But any time that we eventually reverse a conviction and the defendant has spent time in jail, all of that time spent in jail should not have been spent in jail, right?
True, but we're talking...
Well, okay, don't go too fast past the true part. So tell me why that truth does not impact a statute of limitations defense.
Because I don't want the court to confuse rightful time in custody as Levine versus Kling described it. That is to say, someone who proceeds to trial and is convicted and is spending time in custody.
What about the people who spend time in custody before they even have a trial? If they're found not guilty, should they then be entitled to something for that? If we're talking about rightful time in custody, or the charges get dropped?
Maybe. If their time in custody is spent due to the negligence of their attorney, and they're actually innocent and they can show that, they may be able to be recover for that.
Okay, although, so the actual innocence prong would be relevant in that analysis, but not here?
Well, as I think about it, I'm not sure in the pretrial context that would flow, Your Honor. I think if there was a statute of limitations defense, for example, that would serve to cut off the prosecution in a pretrial point through a legal right, I think then you may be able to have that conversation.
Are you asking us just to impose a different policy choice then?
Well, I'm asking, well, yes, essentially, because like the Court of Appeals in Hicks v. Nunnery, adopted policy preferences to bring the innocence requirement into play. I'm asking the court to follow the lead of the state of Washington, Oregon, and recognize that there are limited circumstances in which blind application of the innocence rule would result in an unfair outcome.
How is this unfair?
Because Mr. Skinjaleski could not be prosecuted.
Okay, that's fine, but he belonged in jail. He's guilty.
Well, the legislature said he did not by marking the line at 3 years.
That's the defense, just the same as any other legal defense to a prosecution. The fact is that he's guilty. He knows he's guilty. That's why he pled guilty, right? And now he's coming here to us and saying, I know I'm guilty, but I want recompense for my culpable behavior.
He wants recompense for the 4 months in prison he was not lawfully permitted to serve. He could not have served. And I think
he was there. He was there because of his culpable behavior. I understand the statute of limitations defense gives him a perfect defense to this, but he did do the thing for which he was put in jail.
To Your Honor's point, that is the same analysis. Your Honor's analysis or concern would flow through to the sentencing cases. Those people are in prison or jail because they broke the law.
Yes, but the cases that dealt with sentencing are sentences that went beyond what was lawful, right? So it went beyond what his culpable behavior deserved. That's the point of those cases. He filled up all that sentence that he served. It filled the requirement of his culpable behavior and then went beyond. And in those cases are saying, though, that the part that went beyond had nothing to do with his culpable behavior because that ended at some time prior to that. But in this is all related to his culpable behavior. The fact that he has a perfect defense to it in the statute of limitations does not change the fact that he had culpable behavior and he was in jail because of that.
When Your Honor says someone in the sentencing context served what they deserved, what that person deserved was set forth by the legislature.
But that then goes back to, I think, many of Justice Kelly's previous questions, which is any time someone is aggrieved by a court ruling or something happens in the Department of Corrections and they serve more, or a variety of things, pretrial detention, they're found not guilty, they are in jail for a period of time they shouldn't be, right? For whatever reason. So why wouldn't that then fit the criteria of your request here?
Because here we have a clear line that we can draw from a clear statutory mandate that disallows prosecution of the individual. It is clear. I see my red line is on. May I finish my answer?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. You have a line drawn in the sand, so to speak, about when a prosecution can begin. The prosecutor missed it, filed it. A defense attorney had the case, missed it. Trial court judge who took the plea, missed it, sentenced him. There's absolute immunity for the prosecutor, for the judge, and without extending an exception here for the defense lawyer, I think it would shock the public conscience to know that someone in Mr. Skinjaleski's position, even guilty, can be prosecuted and incarcerated in violation of the law with no one to answer for it. I think that's the situation that we're in.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Brian Keenan on behalf of the respondent, Joseph Smith, Jr. The Court should not recognize an exception that allows a criminal defendant to sue his attorney for malpractice when he was not innocent of the crime for which he was convicted. The Court of Appeals in Hicks followed a majority of states in requiring that a plaintiff prove actual innocence in such a case. Mr. Skinjaleski cannot do so because he admitted that he was guilty of the conduct underlying this conviction, which was stealing money from his customers.
So what do the majority of states say now? We followed them before. Isn't the current state that states are going beyond the innocence requirement in situations such as this one?
I believe there's two states that have gone beyond the innocence requirement, Oregon and Washington, and that's it.
And what about the rest of the states? You're saying they're all with requirements still of only innocence?
They have an actual innocence rule. I don't know if all of them have been presented with, for example, a case like this that has presented that question, but they still have the general rule of actual innocence. And Hicks adopted that rule, and it's been adopted in other courts for several good reasons. I think the primary reason behind the rule is that the plaintiff is ultimately responsible for the consequences of his criminal acts. Had Mr. Skinjaleski not stolen money from his customers, he wouldn't have been charged, and he wouldn't have served any time in jail. Now, there's a subsequent negligent act that his attorney failed to raise a statute of limitations defense. But what these courts recognize is that those subsequent acts don't, like, supersede or negate the ultimate cause of the injury here, which is the criminal conduct of
counsel,
the...
Counsel, do you accept the cases that you're beyond the maximum sentence? Strikes me that those are exceptions to the actual innocence rule. Is it your position that those would be valid exceptions to the actual innocence rule?
That's not our position. It's not presented in this case. I don't think I'm able to, concede that at this point. I think we'd want to see what it would come up in a specific case.
Can you distinguish them?
Yes. I think that the distinction is that what happened in those cases was the criminal defendant took full responsibility for his actions, not just the crime that he committed, but the criminal actions that he did, and that the reasoning of the courts was that, and Powell said, he was more like an innocent man wrongly convicted for that time, at least just for the time period beyond the statutory maximum. And here, Mr. Skinjaleski isn't taking any responsibility at all for his actions. He's not like an innocent man who's wrongly convicted. He's a guilty man whose attorney failed to raise a meritorious defense.
Is it based on accepting responsibility? There's plenty of defendants that never accept responsibility.
Well, that's what the Washington, Oregon courts say, is that when a criminal defendant turned plaintiff is suing just for like a chunk of time that's above and beyond what should have been imposed, that he is accepting responsibility for the conviction and then the lawful sentence, and then is just challenging that like extra unlawful sentence. And so they frame it in taking responsibility.
Okay, but even if they really were just found guilty by a jury and never accepted responsibility and were sentenced by the court, I mean.
Well, I think it's more in terms of the posture of them as civil defendants, that they are not trying to back away from the conviction that happened in the time that they were lawfully served. So they're taking responsibility, maybe not in the criminal context, but in the civil context.
Counsel, how many states have just the actual innocence rule and do not allow any exceptions to it? And there are some other states, like Kansas just rejected the actual innocence rule. So there are some other ones that researched before this that don't have that rule altogether. But how many states do you know just have the actual innocence rule and don't allow any exceptions for things beyond maximum sentence or anything else?
I'm not sure. I know in our brief we have a footnote that listed, I think those are all the states we're aware of, and I'm not sure what the number is, but it's over 15, I believe.
Right. It strikes me, though, that would be a minority position if we were to affirm just the actual innocence rule. And we can, and there are obviously lots of other states that may do that. But if one were looking to what other states have done, that the weight of what our sister courts around the country have done would be to allow some exceptions to the actual innocence rule.
Well, I believe there's the two states, Washington and Oregon. There's Kansas. I think Ohio also has a similar rule to Kansas. So I think that's about four, and maybe there's a few more. So of the states that have been squarely confronted with this, more of them have accepted the actual innocence requirement, or then no requirement at all, or requirement with some exceptions. So I think it's maybe not a majority of 50 states, but the majority of those that have considered it.
I want to give you a question. I was trying to analogize and thinking about this legal malpractice area in relation to other sorts of professional malpractice. And maybe this is a bad question, but it came to my mind, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. So imagine you have a patient who doesn't take care of himself, made a lot of bad choices in life. He's obese, and he has heart failure. And he goes to the hospital. And the doctor performs surgery on his heart. And it's clear that if the doctor had done his job in a competent way, that the patient would not have died. But the doctor screws up, patient dies. In terms of like the who's at fault question, it strikes me as an interesting question, right? I mean, the doctor clearly could have kept him alive. On the other hand, had he made better choices, he certainly wouldn't have been there at all. He put himself in a bad situation, right? How does that analogy compare? How would you think through that in relation to the public policy analysis that we're being asked to conduct here?
Yeah, I think that's somewhat true, although I think the key distinction is that the overweight patient hasn't done anything criminal or wrongful, really. It's just kind of a lack of caring for yourself, which is not good, but it's not morally wrong and it's not necessarily like criminal. And so here I think what the court's underlying the innocence rule is that there's an actual criminal act, you know, a violation of the criminal laws, and that there's just a real feeling amongst these courts that they don't want to use the civil courts then to have someone who's admittedly guilty of a criminal act come into the civil side and then recover damages from their attorney. So I think that's the key distinction from like a medical malpractice type case. And I think the key is, when Mr. Skinjaleski stole the money, he knew at the time that he could spend time in jail, like he ultimately did. And that's the ultimate cause of his injury, is his own criminal conduct. And although his conviction ended up being unlawful because the district attorney delayed in bringing the charges, the case law recognizes that's not necessarily unjust in that he was truly actually guilty of the offense charge.
The state does give compensation to people who are wrongfully imprisoned.
Yes.
If they prove their innocence.
Right.
Statutory.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I was on the claims board for a period of time. When you say that the person who committed the, I guess the difference is there, a person committed the crime or didn't commit the crime.
Yeah, so if you're actually innocent, then that logic doesn't hold because you were wrongfully put in this situation through no fault of your own. And I think there's a key difference here between protections afforded in the criminal law prosecution context and like interests protected by tort law. So Mr. Powell has talked about how there's the statute of limitations is a right. And, you know, in a sense that's true, although what it says is that the prosecution for a misdemeanor must be commenced within 3 years after the commission thereof. So it's a limit on government power, but it really just applies in the criminal law context. And these types of protections don't always cross over and usually don't cross over into imposing civil liability. As Mr. Powell recognized, the party that violated that right in this case was not his own attorney. It was actually the prosecution who brought the charges after the time period had expired. And there is no civil right of recovery from the prosecutor. Courts in the state have been perfectly accepted that there's, you know, that provision applies through the course of a post-conviction, through an appeal, through those kind of things, and it will give you circumstances, but that it wouldn't necessarily impose civil liability on someone who violated that provision. Same would be true of any mistake a judge made. You know, that's precluded. And so it's really not that strange that a provision that applies in the criminal law context doesn't just carry over into the civil law context. And yes, the legislature did put in the statute of limitations, but it didn't impose any sort of liability for failing to do that other than just the prosecution can't happen and Mr. Skinjaleski was let out of jail when this error was found.
If we rejected the claim here for an exception, I'm trying to imagine if there would be any other sorts of claims we might accept in this area. It's that this presents a situation where someone was in prison when the lawyer made did not render professionally competent service, and that you would have had a different result, you know, otherwise. And I think there seemed to be agreement that sort of the first four, standards for a negligence claim would have been satisfied here. So it's just a question of whether it's fair for us to do something different or not. Can you imagine that there'd be other sorts of situations that you've seen in any cases or anything that might be different?
I think a double jeopardy was mentioned. I think it would probably, perhaps there would be a distinction there in that the plaintiff or the plaintiff slash defendant has already been put through this. I don't know if that would be enough of a public policy reason maybe to allow a claim. Now, I don't know if hopefully an attorney won't miss that if his client's already been tried for the same crime, but There is the sentencing cases. Those perhaps, you know, I said we're not conceding that, but, you know, other courts have recognized that. Other than that, I think in general, I don't know that there will be many. And I think some of the questioning before indicated that it's hard to draw certain distinctions because is there really much difference between a statute of limitations versus a failure to move to suppress the one key piece of evidence that gets someone off, or, you know, similar type of defenses. So it may be that there may not be much. I know that even Washington and Oregon have classified their exceptions as very limited and narrow, and so whatever exceptions there are, I think, are going to be few and far between.
What does proving actual innocence look like in a civil trial like this?
Well, I believe the you know, if Mr. Skinjaleski had been innocent, I think he would put forward evidence that I couldn't possibly have stolen this money, or someone else stole it, or and it would be up to the jury to decide whether he was telling the truth or not. That's all I could, you know, it would be on the facts of the case, but I think the plaintiff would just have to put forward the evidence they have, and the defense would put forward evidence they have of guilt, and the jury would have to decide. I think Mr. Skinjaleski says that the exception applies because the Wisconsin court had no authority to convict him, but the rationale of the exception isn't just about whether the court had authority. It's about, like, the culpability of the defendant. And when Mr. Skinjaleski committed this act, he could have been imprisoned. And for him, you know, the DA delayed too long in bringing the charges, and that's the reason he was ultimately released. But at the time he committed the act, he really had no idea that would happen. And so it was foreseeable and, you know, probably probable that he would spend some time in jail for stealing money from his clients like he did. And I think there were some questions on line drawing. I think there are some concerns here that if there is an exception, that not be too broad. I know earlier in the earlier argument, there's discussion of a Mockner hearing. We think there could be some problems to the extent there's a broad exception. You know, once we have this unique Mockner proceeding, if criminal defense attorneys are now looking at civil liability after the conviction is overturned or possibly overturned, that could just complicate that. Perhaps not much in this case, but if, in order for the line drawing issue. And I think, unless anyone else has questions, that's my presentation. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think we look at Johnson versus Babcock of the Oregon case described it, I think the correct way, and that is that was a sentencing case where the defendant got 30 years on an 80-month maximum, and the conclusion of the Oregon Supreme Court was that time spent over the maximum was an unlawful restraint on that person's liberty, and such an outcome is recognizable in the tort context for recovery. And that's what we have here, is an unlawful restraint on Mr. Skinjaleski's liberty because, again, the prosecution was barred by the statute, a line that's been clearly drawn by the statute. And, again, once that time comes to pass, Mr. Skinjaleski's incarceration rests on the negligence of his attorney, not his own conduct. And what we're seeking from this court is a limited and narrow exception, like those adopted in Washington and Oregon, because, frankly, these situations don't happen very often, and they seem limited to these particular types of circumstances, a sentence served beyond the maximum. I have not and did not run across any cases regarding a malpractice action against a criminal attorney for missing a statute of limitations defense. This would be the first to address it. These things just are very rare. but they obviously happen from time to time. So we're not talking about exception, the creation of an exception that would open the floodgates to litigation. That just wouldn't happen. And so what we're asking, and Gillespie is asking this court to do, is to recognize an exception. I think the best way to formulate it is consistent with the Powell Court, which is the where the defendant, well, sorry, it gets confusing, the criminal defense attorney, the malpractice defendant's negligence, results in the imposition of an impermissible sentence, then that should be recognized as an exception to the innocence requirement in legal malpractice cases against criminal defense attorneys. I think from my review of the case law and cases cited in my brief, I think as a practical matter, you run down three circumstances, that being, again, a sentence over the maximum, the prosecution and sentence in violation of the statute of limitations, and potentially a double jeopardy claim if one exists. So I ask the court to adopt such an exception. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you both very much for bringing an interesting problem before the court. Obviously, it's one this court has never looked at before, and we'll see what we do with it after we discuss it further. I'm going to now adjourn until our third case, which is at 1:30. Justice Gallet will be down to talk to the people from University School in just a few minutes. As will I.
Thank you.